We're talking about an art exhibit that focuses on incarceration in America. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The art on display at UW-Stevens Point focuses on the number of prisons in America and specifically the impact on juveniles behind bars. Have you seen this exhibit? What did you take away from the art? Have you been incarcerated? What was your experience like? You can join in throughout the hour as we talk about criminal justice issues. We're at 800-642-1234. Wes Janz grew up on a farm near Stevens Point, and he's the artist behind Pinned Down, The Locking Up of America, and the exhibit is on display at the Edna Carlston Art Gallery in Stevens Point. Wes was an architecture professor at Ball State University in Indiana for 22 years. Wes, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thanks so much for having me this morning.
Well, you grew up in central Wisconsin. You've been a professor of architecture many years. What made you want to explore incarceration and criminal justice?
Great question. So when I was a professor, I started taking students to South Asia and Latin America. And so as part of those trips, I would often find myself in large informal settlements or shanty towns, tens of thousands of people living in conditions that we'd say were pretty desperate, but they were making their way, which I had tremendous respect for. I also started working in the Rust Belt, primarily at the Genesee County Land Bank in Flint, Michigan, about 10 to 12 years ago. And in a similar way, I was running into a lot of people who were living on front porches, living in alleys, living in garages. And while they were also desperate, I also found a kind of encouragement from their ability to make their way. About that time, I was asked to join a reading group at an all-Black Methodist church in West Indianapolis, where I live. And they were reading, we were reading, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. And that's a book that talks about the development from the Civil War period through Reconstruction, convict leasing, up to the what we would have called Jim Crow. But the new Jim Crow, she argues, is related to mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex. And so when I was in that, I sort of participated there for about 6 months through a long winter. And it was amazing to me to both read the book and to read about this mass incarceration industry in the United States, and also to hear Black folks talk about their experiences with police officers, with the court. And that sort of led me to a lot of rethinking about the things I should be focused on as a citizen primarily, but also then as a professor and an architect.
So at what point did you decide that you could tell a story through art installations that would be the medium to discuss incarceration?
I guess I was asked if I thought that I could do that by some gallery curators. And I was at that around that time, about 8 to 10 years ago, I was curating shows what I related more to this topic of leftover people living in shanty towns around the world and also in the Rust Belt of the United States. And then as my interest turned to mass incarceration, colleagues and others saw that and asked me if I could get involved. So maybe about 2 years ago, I did the first bit of work in this area at Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky, in a show that I did called Crazy for Cages, where I did a series of installations about people that we've thrown away in our society by going to a Goodwill outlet store and only purchasing materials that we as a society and individuals have thrown away also. Some of those works are in the show at the Edna Carlston Gallery here in Stevens Point.
Well, let's take a look at what is on display in Stevens Point. It's called Pinned Down, The Locking Up of America. And you blend art and architecture. You can kind of see where your inspirations come from. Can you describe the pieces you've created using maps, first of all? What do they look like and what are you showing through them?
Yeah. Thanks. Maybe 2 years ago, I got stranded in a snowstorm in Wisconsin in Racine, And my wife and I watched Making a Murderer. We binge watched it in a hotel in Racine, Wisconsin in a snowstorm. And this is a story that takes place on Netflix in Manitowoc County. And I was sort of amazed as I watched it by many things as an architect, including how I knew so little about the facilities and the buildings and the correctional campuses that existed in what I considered to be my own backyard in Manitowoc County. And so I came back to school and I had a couple of my, I just picked up a Rand McNally map of Indiana on my way to school one day and a box of pushpins. And I came into a couple classes and I said, we're going to map all the sites of incarceration in the state of Indiana today. And I think everyone, as we did that, was pretty astonished at the sort of the coverage of federal prison sites, state prison sites, county jails, local jails, and other sites of incarceration in Indiana. So that led me, when I was contacted by a curator at UWSP at the Carlston Gallery to do a show, asked to do a show, I said, I'd like to do 10 maps for 10 different states using a similar means, map, Rand McNally maps, and different colored pushpins. So there's 10 maps. Five of them are of Midwestern states, Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, Indiana, and Michigan. And then five of them are of other states around the country, California, Colorado, Texas, Florida, and New York. And so that's the primary, those are the primary visuals in the show. Each one of those states then has what I just basically call the cover sheet. For each state, I picked a topic that's central to the consideration of mass incarceration, and wrote just a short, like 200-word blurb about that issue as it's nested within that particular state.
We're talking with Wes Jantz. He is a Wisconsin native artist behind the Pin Down, the Locking Up of America. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this exhibit or other artworks about incarceration? How do they make you feel? And have you been incarcerated? What was your experience? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Wes, when you literally map this out, where incarceration facilities are in these 10 different states that you picked, what did you see there? What came to life through these visuals?
I think for everyone that I've talked to who sees the show, there's just a realization that what I would call there's a blanket of incarceration facilities that we move in, exist in, work in, live in. And I don't think we really understand that at all. Sometimes I've talked to folks who've said, gee, I thought there was one or two jails in the state of Indiana. And it turns out that there's probably over 500 jails or prisons in the state of Indiana. On the state of Wisconsin map, I've been able to identify 590 sites of incarceration, federal prisons, state prisons, locals, this whole gamut of categories of incarceration. And I think that's the main takeaway. For me, it was just a chance to see that for myself and then to help others understand that better about their own lives and the world that they occupy.
We're talking about the exhibition on display in Stevens Point called Pinned Down, The Locking Up of America. Wisconsin native artist and architect behind the works, Wes Jantz, stays with us. You can join in 800-642-1234. Have you seen the Pin Down exhibit? What did you take away from the art? Do you have a family or friend in criminal detention? What's your take on how it is or isn't working? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the discussion with Wes in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about an art exhibition on display in Stevens Point that focuses on incarceration in America. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One of the underlying themes conveyed in the works is the idea that mass incarceration is a system that profits based on the number of people within prison systems. Have you seen the exhibit Pinned Down or other artwork that speaks to criminal justice? What are your takeaways? How does it make you feel? Join in at 800-642-1234. Wes Jantz stays with us, and his exhibit Pinned Down, The Locking Up of America is on display at the Edna Carlston Art Gallery in Stevens Point. Wes, what have been some of the takeaways from people who have seen these maps? Because it seems that there may be this general sense that people are unaware that there is this much incarceration or this much industry in these 10 states.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that's the main takeaway, I think, from the people that I've talked to. You know, I've had interesting conversations with students at UWSP related to ethics, the ethics of incarceration, and from our professional and societal perspective. I think also there's just this unawareness that I think we could really call ourselves the world's leaders when it comes to incarceration. We've got 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners. You know, we lead all industrialized nations in the number of people that we're incarcerating per 100,000 citizens. We incarcerate in the United States a higher percentage of our Black population than South Africa at the height of apartheid. And maybe among the most amazing things to me is we have the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that was intended to prohibit and end slavery, but it has an exception that where if you're being punished for a crime that you've been duly convicted of, you can still be considered to be a slave. That's in the U.S. Constitution, the 13th Amendment. And so I don't think people really understand the kind of foundations. That's a surprise everyone has when I start to talk to them about some of these basic facts about the United States and mass incarceration. That's a huge surprise.
Well, let's go to the phones now with Greg joining us from Cedar Hill, Missouri. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, ma'am.
What is your story and your connection to this?
Well, ma'am, the reason for my phone call is I'm just in Wisconsin on business, but I was incarcerated at Terre Haute, Indiana for 10 months for a federal crime. And that crime was burning my own barn without a permit, which is a structure. I never got in any trouble before. I served my time. I got out. I was branded a felon. I'm unable to get a job because I'm branded a felon. I'm unable to vote and unable to carry a gun. Now, I don't have a problem with not carrying a gun. I do feel I have a right to vote because I did serve my time in Vietnam in 1968.
Great. Greg, may I stop you and ask, how is life today?
I'm sorry, what did you say, ma'am?
How is your life today?
Well, my life today is tough because once you're branded a felon, you know, all your family is embarrassed. It's really hard because you can't earn a living. You can't get a job. People will not hire you because you have a felony conviction.
Wes, I want you to jump in here because you did a lot of research on incarceration in Indiana.
Wow. Greg, thanks so much, man. That's both a hard story to hear, and I think in many ways a common story to hear in the United States. Terre Haute, I'll just say Terre Haute is an amazing place. I've just visited the grounds of that prison. No one that I've talked to in the state of Indiana, and maybe I'm talking here, Kate, about a couple dozen people, knows that the only federal execution chamber in the United States is in Terre Haute, Indiana. Timothy McVeigh was executed in Terre Haute. So Greg's been to a place that's among the very most serious places of incarceration in the world, certainly in the United States. And I'm just starting to understand what's called felony disenfranchisement. That's what Greg's talking about, how people who've been incarcerated lose these rights as basic citizens. They've done their time. They've done what society asked them and demanded that they do because of a crime that they've been convicted of. And still so many of the basic rights of being a citizen are denied them for the rest of their lives and held against them for the rest of their lives. It's a sad state of affairs. Greg, man, thanks for calling, really.
Let's go to Rich now in Rhinelander. Rich, hi.
Hi, good morning. I read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, and I need the artist to respond to this on my part. It seems to me that the jails and prisons of the United States are our poorhouses. We like to think we've eliminated what we consider to be, 18th century England, poorhouses and persecution of the poor. But my little bit of acquaintance with people who have been in jail or in prison, the people who wind up in jail and in prison are people who don't have the means for a proper defense often of their cases, which the state brings against them. He may not be able to answer this as an artist, but I do want to at least put out there my contention that we're persecuting the poor.
Wes, go ahead.
Yeah, Rich, totally, man. Right, that's absolutely the case, is my understanding of the situation. There's a great lawyer in Montgomery, Alabama, named Brian Stevenson, who's started a nonprofit called the Equal Justice Initiative. And he has a great book out named Just Mercy and a great TED Talk as well, Rich. You might track that down. But he says, to summarize your point in a great way, that it's better to be white and wealthy than it is to be it's better to be wealthy and guilty than it is to be poor and innocent. It's better to be wealthy and guilty than it is to be poor and innocent. I've been going, Rich, to juvenile court for about a year and a half. I go 2 days a month. I've heard almost 500 hearings. And at first I was interested in maybe racial distinctions among the youth that were there, interested in their ages and their gender. But really what I'm seeing in juvenile court is a whole bunch of people who are living difficult lives, who are living in what we'd call poverty. In a good way, the public defenders that I see in court are very good. They're very dedicated to the young people that they're defending and advocating on behalf of. But absolutely, to go to court is to see the poor people of the United States and how many industries, including the court system, I think in some ways, are profiting from their incarceration and their locking up.
Wes, I want to get to your other installations in the exhibit before our time is up. You've created the pieces that portray your impression of incarceration and an overcrowded cage. Can you tell us about this cage piece?
Yeah. Thanks, Kate. So I was going to the Goodwill outlet store, not their storefronts, but the stuff that doesn't sell in the storefronts goes to an outlet store. And then if it doesn't sell there, it gets shipped to a landfill or to some other part of the world or the United States. And so I bought a raccoon trap there for about 50 cents. And then I started buying a whole bunch of very small dolls, like several hundred of them. And I just pushed them down into the heart, the center, the void of this cage. And so the piece has all these small human figures in it with maybe arms sticking out, a head sticking out, a foot sticking out, because I'm really trying to just put on display the idea of this overcrowding and the fullness of the prison system, and as a society, really, our dedication to keeping all these prisons and jails full. In Alabama, as I understand it, the state prisons are operating at almost 200% of their design capacity, and this just can't be tolerated by us as a society.
And very quickly, what about the Charlie Brown part of the exhibit?
Yeah, thanks. I started finding Charlie Brown dolls because there was some sort of Peanuts movie maybe 5 years ago, I guess, at the Goodwill outlet store. And so I came home and I looked up in the Indiana Department of Corrections archive how many Charles Browns were incarcerated in the history of the system. And there's 28 men named Charles Brown who've been incarcerated in Indiana. And I thought that was pretty amazing. So I just started lining up these dolls and buying as many of them as as I could. But, you know, it's a different way to cut through this whole block of people who've been locked up by sort of saying, gee, I wonder how many people named Donna Johnson, I wonder how many people named Michael Smith have been arrested in Wisconsin, for example. Yes.
Well, Wes, thank you so much for sharing your art with us and for spending this time.
It's been awesome. And thanks, especially, I want to say, Kate, to Greg and Rich for reaching out with their stories and their questions. Thank you so much, man.
Wes Jantz is a Wisconsin native, the artist behind Pin Down, The Locking Up of America. It's an exhibit currently on display at the Edna Carlston Art Gallery in Stevens Point. He was a professor of architecture at Ball State in Indiana for 22 years. We'll continue the conversation on criminal justice right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin criminal justice issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly half of the U.S. prison population is now serving time for a violent offense. Here in Wisconsin, prisons held a record number of adults in 2017, and the population continues to grow. And that's according to the research organization Wisconsin Policy Forum. Have you followed changes in Wisconsin's approach to criminal justice? What things do you want to see acted on? Do you support the closure of Lincoln Hills? How do you think smaller regional juvenile facilities will impact juvenile justice? What questions do you have about the broader trends you see in incarceration? We're at 800-642-1234. Email is ideas@wpr.org. Mark Osler is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, and as a former federal prosecutor, his work focuses on clemency, sentencing, and narcotics policy. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with, after years of alleged inmate abuse and neglect and staffing challenges, safety issues, former Governor Walker signed a law closing Wisconsin's Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake juvenile schools just about a year ago. And Wisconsin plans to instead have these multiple regional detention facilities. What have you seen regarding the success of smaller regional juvenile facilities? What do we know about them?
Well, one of the prime benefits of going to that approach is definitely that they're able to be located closer to population centers. When you have the one big center, you know, it's often away from where the juveniles are from. And especially with kids, the connection to community and family is especially important. So if we're shipping most of the kids across state to a single location, that's going to be more damaging than having multiple locations where the travel time is going to be reasonable for family, for the support network that we hope will be there for the juvenile when they are released from the facility.
So perhaps consolidating into one place in the state may be more cost effective, but smaller, more community-based centers around the state would be more effective for justice?
Well, not only for justice, but for the community and safety. You know, what we want to come out of juvenile justice is to have kids who are coming back, who are ready to go to school, who are going to go on to the next step and not go into the next step of crime. Especially with kids, that happens best when there's a close connection to the community they're coming from, to their family, if that's possible. So, yeah, that is one of the biggest benefits. The other is that we also know there's some benefits to downsizing, just in terms of staffing, of being able to have more attention to each individual who comes into the facility.
How has juvenile detention changed and evolved in the last few decades?
Well, we've seen it, like a lot of criminal justice over the past 40 years, say, we've seen a move towards more retribution, more juveniles that are taken into the adult system, and the juvenile systems themselves have become more like regular prisons. And lately, there's been a move away from that that's driven both by horror stories about what's happening in some of the juvenile facilities, including Lincoln Hills. You have the idea that this isn't working in terms of preventing recidivism. And finally, I think there is a sense that retribution is directed towards juveniles doesn't fit what we're learning about brain science and about the data that relates to that, which is that, you know, often the thinking of harsh retribution against juveniles was that this is a super predator, as the term once was used by some politicians, who's never going to be able to become a productive member of society. We know now that people's brains change into their 20s, and that often the person who's in front of you at 16 is going to be different than the person that appears at 30 or 40 or 50.
Staffing shortages have been a real issue at Wisconsin's juvenile institutions, and some have raised concerns about safety and work conditions. Governor Tony Evers has included a pay raise for correctional officers in his proposed budget. Are we seeing poor conditions for staff and shortages across the nation in our prisons?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, that's a very common problem right now. That we have, especially as the economy has improved, there's other options for people who would work in prisons. And so many prison systems are having problems attracting good staff that will stay there for a long time. And that's another thing, too, is not just the staffing levels, but the levels of a turnover. And where we see a lot of turnover, and that means that you've got people with less experience, less training, who are doing the bulk of the work. And that's part of the problem, too. I don't think the solution is, a worse economy. I think the solution is going to be things like the governor's talking about. We're going to have to pay people more. We're going to have to provide better training. And we're going to have to, change the focus of the work some as well.
Talking with Mark Osler, he's a professor of law, former prosecutor. You can join in the conversation about criminal justice. 800-642-1234. Have you followed the changes regarding juvenile justice in Wisconsin? Do you support the closure of Lincoln Hills? How do you think smaller regional facilities will impact juvenile justice? Wisconsin inmates are protesting the practice of solitary confinement. What are your thoughts on behavioral practices in jails? We're at 800-642-1234. Mark, the Green Bay Correctional Institution is a maximum security facility housing 300 more inmates than it was originally designed for. Replacing the facility is estimated to cost $500 million. Statewide, Wisconsin adult detention centers are running at 32% over capacity. What do we know about overcrowding and how to pay for it?
Well, overcrowding is a terrible problem, especially if we look at the broader goal of what we're after here, which is, having people come out of prison, come back into society, and not be a threat to the rest of society. That if the conditions are terrible, we're not doing our job of rehabilitation, and there's no chance of that. And that's one of the biggest dangers. And it's cruel, frankly, what happens in prisons like Green Bay. I mean, you're looking at 1,100 people in a facility that was designed for 750. That's never going to work, especially in a 100-year-old facility. Now, in terms of what do you do instead of replacing the prison, I think what the governor hopes for is to shrink the size of the overall population of the prisons. But to do that, you're going to have to kind of redeploy your resources and look at the whole of the prison system. And as I understand it, that's being studied right now. It's not that Green Bay is the only prison in the system. You've got, I think, over 30,000 people. That's only 1,100. So if there can be changes in terms of the number of people brought into the system and the way that we use alternatives to incarceration, it could be that the system adjusts so that other facilities can take up that slack and you don't have to build a new prison. The problem with building new prisons is once we build them, we tend to fill them. And right now we know that probably we're over-incarcerating, especially in places like Wisconsin.
Governor Evers has also proposed expanding a program that provides support to offenders with mental health issues when they're released. What do we know about the levels of incarcerated people with mental health challenges?
They're very high. And one of the things we see is that some of the biggest jail systems in the country are also the largest dispensers of psychotropic medications. So this is a huge problem because obviously mental health is something that's in society's interest to address among incarcerated people, and especially incarcerated people who are coming back into society. And we're not doing a very good job of that. One of the things that the governor's proposal takes on that's especially important is that, in larger urban areas, you have facilities that are able to help people with mental health issues readjust. But in rural areas, it's more rare. And part of what he's dedicating is more resources to those with mental health issues in rural areas when they return to their communities. And I think that's really important in a state like Wisconsin.
And Milwaukee County has announced a plan to transition all health care for inmates in-house and move away from using these private companies for medical services. How is health care handled around the country for prisoners?
It varies wildly, unfortunately. That we have some terrible health care systems in prisons, and we have some that are decent. The problem, of course, is that you have low-bid health care in a lot of places, and there's not a lot of attention paid. It's difficult for a prisoner to speak up about health care and be heard a lot of times, in part because sometimes they're wrong, sometimes they're asking for too much, but sometimes they're right. And the discernment between those groups is sometimes not being made. But, prisoners, because of the high level of mental health problems, because of the nature of prison, where many people are sedentary, the healthcare costs can be substantial. And unfortunately, that's often where they look first to cut when they need to cut in the prison.
Do people who are incarcerated generally have more medical needs and require more attention?
Well, probably not than the population as a whole, because of the youth of, relative youth of people in prison. But relative to people their own age, I think probably it is fairly high. And then when we get to the fact that we have so many people serving life without parole, you've got the costs that come with having geriatric prisons, basically, where it's everything that you have to put into a nursing home, you have to put into a prison if you're going to do it in a way that doesn't violate the Constitution.
We're looking at criminal justice trends at home here in Wisconsin and across the nation with Mark Osler as our guide. Wisconsin inmates are protesting the practice of solitary confinement, and we want to know, what are your thoughts on behavioral practice in jails and prisons? What legislation regarding incarceration, federally or statewide, do you think is necessary? You can join in at 800-642-1234 for this conversation about criminal justice. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in a minute with more conversation right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about criminal justice issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When Governor Tony Evers was on the campaign trail, he vowed to halve the state's prison population, which is estimated to reach a record 25,000 by 2021. He called it, quote, a goal that's worth accomplishing. And so we're looking at the state of criminal justice here in Wisconsin and trend lines across the country with your insights along the way at 800-642-1234. And correctional officers, what is your experience like? What issues have you encountered on the job? What parts of incarceration do you feel are misunderstood? Or where do you see room for improvement? What legislation regarding incarceration do you think is necessary? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. University of St. Thomas law professor and former prosecutor Mark Osler is our guide. Let's go now to talk about solitary confinement here. And it was reported recently that one or more Wisconsin inmates were refusing food as a way to protest the practice of solitary confinement. And Wisconsin activists have also been speaking up against the practice of isolating inmates. Has solitary confinement been studied enough, Mark? What do we know about long-term effects?
Yeah, well, not as much as we should. A lot of what we know is from the public statements by people who've suffered through solitary confinement. We've got hundreds in this country who have been held in solitary confinement for more than 6 years. And you can imagine the damage that that does. Internationally, solitary confinement is considered generally a form of torture unless it's done for very short periods of time when absolutely necessary. So what we're seeing is that solitary confinement is used as basically a cost-effective measure to maintain safety. But there's great cost to the people who are held. The other thing, too, is that the psychological damage that that does, very often it's being done to someone who will be released back into society. We forget about that. We think that once the prison door closes, all those people are serving life terms, but they're not. And when we overuse solitary confinement, when we create the kind of psychological issues that it does, we often forget that those people are going to come back and be our neighbors.
Let's go to the phones now with Kendall joining us from Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Kendall.
Hello.
And you're a retired prison chaplain.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I was a federal prison chaplain for over 20 years, and part of our job was to do rounds in the special housing units every week. And did 16 of those years, I was at high security penitentiaries, and the pain those guys were going through back there drove them to like self-mutilation to try to get out of there. I mean, I've seen guys, I don't even want to say it over the phone, do horrible things to themselves just so that they could be taken out to a hospital or something because it was just driving them crazy.
And this wasn't when you were visiting solitary confinement?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Mutilating themselves because they were just desperate to be able to have some kind of human interaction, to have medical people come in. And I mean, they're supposed to do rounds on the guys every hour or even more frequently. That doesn't always happen.
So based on your experience in spending 20 years visiting solitary confinement, what do you want to know? What is your question?
Well, one, how can we come alongside these guys that are protesting, because they are hidden back there, and people don't know what's happening to them, and what can we do to the public to help get that message out? This is something, isn't that just something somebody else in another country is doing that's torture, we're upset. Well, this is something we're doing. We pay the fee. We pay the cost for prisons to run. We pass the laws, and so if we let this go on, we're allowing torture. We're allowing people to get in situations.
Well, let's go back to Mark Osler and get your insights.
Well, I just have to say, Kendall, thanks so much for calling in, because what you have to say, that eyewitness to what happens, so important to put out there. And, what you tell me is what I've heard from a lot of other people. To solve this problem, we have to spend some money. There are things that can be done with prison design, with staffing, that will allow us to greatly reduce the amount of solitary confinement. And because of the human cost to prisoners and eventually to us, it's essential that we spend the money to avoid the kinds of things that Kendall's talking about.
Let's go to Mary Kay now in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Good morning. What I see here is, first, we need an alternative to jail. We used to have county-run group homes that inmates used to live in, and they'd go to work, they'd go to school, they'd go to counseling, wherever they had to go. Okay, those are not here anymore. They're back in jail. There need to be more people on bracelets, and they can do the same thing, go to work, go to counselor, go wherever they got to go. Okay, in the jails, we need to start at more guards. They need more family visits. They only get a 30-minute visit by family or loved ones a week. They should have at least 60 minutes. GEDs for all inmates. They should have practice tests. A community garden, maybe beekeeping, some kind of job, crafts, okay? And volunteers, mentors. Okay.
Mary Kay, thank you. And she has listed off a number of things, Mark Osler.
Yes, she did. And she's right about the programming, that we've eliminated so much of that within America's prisons. The things that allowed for education, for GED, for college courses in the prison, the elimination of Pell Grants for that was really significant. In terms of halfway houses or community corrections facilities, which is what she's talking about, where people stay there, work during the day, we still have those, but they're usually used or very often used instead of an alternative to incarceration. They're used at the end of incarceration. So if someone does an 8-year term, the last 6 months will be in the halfway house. The problem with that is that it doesn't allow the continuity of employment. If we sentence someone to the halfway house and have them serve the time there, while they're in, they are able to maintain the contact with their family, maintain the job that they have. Whereas if we have a prison term in between, the offense and the halfway house, all that is lost and it's starting over from scratch.
Well, Adam from Deerfield called in to ask you about capital punishment when he says we think about the population in prison for life without parole. He said that it's expensive. If they can't be rehabbed, put back into society, what about capital punishment?
Well, just to address the cost issue, it's more expensive to sentence someone to death than to have them do life without parole, actually, which I know is counterintuitive because you think, well, if we execute them, we don't have to pay anything anymore. And the reason is because if we kill someone, we have to be absolutely sure we've got the right person, that this is constitutional. And that means we're paying both sides of the legal team, the prosecution and a defense team, to go all the way up on appeal, to do state habeas, to do federal habeas. And so in almost every jurisdiction, it's more expensive to have someone sentenced to death than to have them sentenced to life without parole. So in terms of that, unfortunately, for that argument anyways, that doesn't hold up once we examine the numbers.
Late last year, Congress passed a bipartisan criminal justice bill. Are you seeing consensus on this issue nationwide? Is criminal justice reform getting more traction?
It really is. And what has changed has been energy from the right. We had a conference at my school last Friday, a symposium about clemency, which is one aspect of the whole system. But the people that were speaking in favor of a broader use of clemency included not only, the usual group of progressives, but we had Mark Holden, who's the general counsel of Koch Industries. We had Paul Larkin from the Heritage Foundation, who agree that we are not serving our citizens well through our current system of incarceration. And that, when we take away freedom, that we need to be sure that we're solving a problem when we do that, and we're failing at that. And so really there's bipartisan energy, and you saw that with the First Step Act that came through the federal government, which was celebrated at the White House yesterday, actually, that the people behind that were not only Democrats, but you had people like Mike Lee, who is a strong proponent of it, the conservative senator from Utah.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Mark Osler is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, former federal prosecutor, and focuses on clemency, sentencing, and narcotics policy. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.